Howdy, South by Southwest. How's everybody doing? It's almost over. No, it's not over yet. You got plenty of beer to drink. Well, some of you do. And another day. So we're going to be here back tomorrow as well. We've got two more speakers, and we're going to kick it off with our next speaker in just a minute. We have with us Chris Guillebeau and his upcoming book, The $100 Startup. Chris is an author. You may know him for his book, The Art of Nonconformity, and he's going to talk to us about his insights of how to build a business in a world where people can operate from Buenos Aires to Bangkok with $100, right? $100? All right. Well, we're going to figure out more about that in just seconds here. And a big round of applause, South by Southwest book author stage, Ogilvy Day Stage for Chris. Thank
you. Thanks a lot, man. Great job. Thank you so much. Good to see you guys. I'm so honored to be here and really appreciate you coming out. I was worried no one would be here with this 5 p.m. time slot during the pre-drinking hour. But then I was informed that there's no such thing in Austin. So you guys are awesome. Really appreciate South by Southwest providing this platform. This is the first preview of the $100 startup, of the data and kind of backstory behind it. So I'm glad to do that here today. And afterwards, I don't have finished copies of the book because it doesn't come out until May. But I have some advanced copies, and I'll be at the bookstore, and those will actually be free, first come, first served. So, of course, I think I have about 40 of them, so that's great. So in talking about, you know, a book or a big project or anything that you create, I always think it's important to define your own success and to decide for yourself, you know, what you'd like to see come out of it. And in the case of writing a book, I think it's important to understand to whom you're writing, as well as maybe who the book isn't a good fit for. And so, you know, my goal, as I set out to write this book, was to ensure that it wasn't a conventional, boring business book. And I got some really good advice from my editor in the beginning of the process. And he said, you know, Chris, you use this word entrepreneur a lot. And I want you to think about that a little bit, because in some circles with some groups, you know, maybe that makes sense. But other people have a lot of assumptions or questions about that word. And a lot of people who are just working regular jobs, maybe they don't actually have a desire, you know, to be an entrepreneur or to found a company or found a business. So think about that a little bit. And this book is not about founding a big company. It's not about creating a tech startup and getting investors and cashing out. It's not about how to be a better manager of employees. And instead, this book, The $100 Startup, is really about freedom. And the people that it's for, it's for those who are dissatisfied and those who are seeking a change and those who are, you know, not really happy doing what they're doing for whatever reason. But they don't necessarily know, you know, what the next step is. So it's for that person who, you know, wants to escape perhaps, who wants to create some more freedom for themselves. They don't necessarily want to have a big company, but they don't know what to do next. And it's also for those who are just entering the job market, or for those who might be struggling to compete in a more limited job market. So where I live in Portland, Oregon, it's not uncommon at all to go for coffee, and every barista behind the counter has a college degree. And some of them might have a master's degree, you know, or even more. And last year in Portland, there was a job opening that was announced for a receptionist job that paid $14 an hour with no benefits. And 300 people showed up to apply for that job. Many of them were college graduates. So it used to be when you would hear of someone who, you know, wasn't able to find work in their chosen field, or maybe had, you know, trained for, you know, a particular job and then wasn't able to find a job in that field. It used to be that we would think maybe they had fallen on hard times. Perhaps in the back of our mind we were thinking that there's maybe something wrong with them. But I would suggest that when you have situations where 300 people, you know, are all applying for an entry-level job, the answer to that is not, you know, those people should try harder, you know. They should stand out somehow and polish their resume, because that's not going to work, you know, for many of them. And so I would suggest a better answer for many of those people is to create their own security and to create their own freedom. And I think there's more stability and security in working for yourself than in trying to compete in that kind of job market. So the best way to tell you more about the $100 startup model is to tell you a few stories of the people that are in the book. So when we began this process a couple of years ago, we did this very comprehensive research study. We cast a wide net. We said we're looking to hear from people who are unexpected or unconventional entrepreneurs. And we had some very specific criteria for that. The first thing was you need to make at least $50,000 a year in your business. And a lot of people made a lot more, but that was the baseline. The second thing was you had to have started this business for a very low cost, usually less than $1,000, and in most cases, you know, about $100 or less. In fact, I think the average was something like $434, but we decided that the $434 startup wasn't a very good title. So the $100 startup is how that came about. You had to have 5 employees or fewer. In fact, many of the people were just one-person businesses, you know, just operating, you know, by themselves as solopreneurs. And you had to provide full disclosure of your finances, which are all in the book, so you can hear exactly how much money people make and how they started the business and the mistakes and things that went wrong, because we wanted to be very specific and not vague. And the last thing was the person operating the business had to do it with no special skills, or at least no skills that couldn't be easily acquired, you know, by someone else. So I heard from this one guy in Croatia who said he was a DIY dentist. He had taught himself dentistry. And I said, that's awesome, but I'm not putting it in the book. So we originally had about 1,500 submissions from all over the world, very diverse. And I chose 70 of them to go in the final manuscript. And these people come from all walks of life, very different stories, but in some ways, you know, very similar decisions, you know, that they made to get where they are. And the book begins with the story of Michael Hanna. And Michael was a middle-aged guy working as an ad executive for a media company. And every day he went to work in this office and he spent his time on client pitches and meetings and emails. And one day he goes to work and he gets a message from his boss saying she would like to see him after lunch. So he goes in and he sits down and he notices that his boss doesn't look him in the eye. And she says, you know, Michael, I'm sure you're aware that, you know, there's been some changes in the company because of the state of the industry. And he said, you know, after that, everything just happened in slow motion. And I had heard stories, you know, of this happening to other people. I'd seen some of our colleagues had been laid off. But until it happened to me, you know, I just never could imagine it. And someone from HR came in and gave him a box. And, you know, he had to pack up his stuff and leave right away. And so he's driving home and he calls his wife, Mary Ruth, and says, you know, honey, I lost my job today. And Michael was, you know, a pretty strong guy. He was a great worker. And so after the initial shock wore off, he said, okay, I'll get out there and I'll find another job, you know, because I'm sure I can. And what Michael discovered, you know, he was a great worker, he had a lot of experience, but he wasn't the only one, you know, looking for a job. And his whole industry was kind of changing and downsizing, and other people were willing to do the job for less money, and he really wasn't sure what he was going to do. And so one day, a friend of his who owned a furniture business called him, and his friend said, you know, I have this truckload of mattresses. It's kind of random, but, you know, maybe you want them. Maybe you could sell them one at a time on Craigslist or something. So Michael wasn't doing anything else that day. He called Mary Ruth again and said, honey, it's a long story, but can I buy a truckload of mattresses? And so he bought the truckload of mattresses, and instead of selling them on Craigslist, you know, he had been driving around looking for a job, and he noticed that there was a car dealership that had gone out of business. And he realized that the landlord wasn't actually making any rent, and who else is going to rent a car dealership, you know, the height of the recession? So he was able to rent that space, you know, for very little money. And Michael didn't know anything about mattresses. His whole impression of mattress stores was that they were kind of seedy, high-pressure places. And so he decided to create the opposite of that. And he said, we're going to create this fun space, you know, and we're going to invite the community to come. We're going to have a space for kids to play. You know, we don't really know what we're doing in terms of the mattress industry, but we're going to have fun. And so he sold out of that truckload of mattresses, and he started contacting suppliers. Ended up building an unconventional mattress store. And that was 2 years ago. And I just talked to him recently, and that store now does $1 million in revenue. And he talks about the odd reality that, you know, a few years ago, if you had told him, you know, he would be running a mattress store or even any business of any kind, he'd have no idea. But he said, actually, in retrospect, you know, getting laid off was the best thing that ever happened to me. And as I talked with, you know, people like Michael and the other people in the book, I learned that many of them had stories of, you know, not really having a strategy, sometimes not even having an intention of starting a business before they did. So I talked with Susanna Conway in England, and Susanna was a journalist, and she was also an artist and photographer on the side, and she started a business teaching photography classes, both online and locally. And that business now earns almost $200,000 a year. And when I asked her, I said, what did you not foresee in starting up? And she said, I didn't know I was starting up. I really had no idea. I just offered my first class to my friends and family, and everyone signed up. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll offer this to my blog readers. You know, she didn't have a lot of blog readers, but, you know, she had enough. And now that's what she does full time. I met Benny Lewis in Bangkok, and Benny describes himself as a professional language hacker. He travels the world learning languages full-time and teaching other people to learn languages. He speaks 8 or 9 languages. He's under 25 years old. And when I talked with him, we did our interview, and I said, is there anything else I should know about your business? And he said, yes, please stop calling it a business. I'm having the time of my life. And so, you know, the book includes a lot of detailed information, again, including the finances, of people like Michael and Susanna and Benny, you know, all with the goal of creating this narrative that provides a blueprint, you know, for other people to do the same thing in different ways. And the book is 300 pages, but in super quick summary form, here's how these people did it. 3 steps. Step one, all of these unconventional entrepreneurs found a way to combine something that they were passionate about, something that they were very skilled in, with something that was also valued by other people, with something that other people were willing to pay for. And so I call this the magic lesson of passion plus usefulness, or the magic formula of passion plus usefulness. And another word to think about it is convergence. If you can imagine 2 circles, and you know, in one circle you have everything that you're really excited about, everything that you love to do, that you're skilled in, everything that brings you joy and energy. And you have this other circle of things that are valued by the marketplace, things that people are willing to pay for. In most cases, there's probably a little overlapping section somewhere between the things that you love to do and the things that other people are paying for, are willing to pay for. And in very different ways, everyone in the study found a way of doing that. The second step is to give people what they really want, not necessarily what they say they want, because these things can sometimes be different. So you've probably heard this old parable, give a man to fish, he'll eat for a day. You know, teach a man to fish and he'll fish for a lifetime. I think that's a great idea if you're working with homeless fishermen. In business, it's often a terrible idea because people often don't want to learn how to fish. You know, most of us, when we want fish, we want the fish to be brought to us. You know, we want someone else to deal with the fish. We just want to have the fish. And in fact, you know, we're willing to pay for it. And so a lot of people started really interesting, you know, unusual but successful businesses, finding a way to give people what they really want. One example is a guy named Gary Leff from Arlington, Virginia. And Gary actually has a full-time job. He's a CFO. He likes his job. He's happy there. But he's managed to start, you know, a whole side income of more than $100,000 a year, helping executives use their frequent flyer miles to book awards tickets. So there's lots of, you know, executives that have all these frequent flyer miles, but they don't know what to do with them. And Gary's service, you know, is that he'll take their miles for a fee, and he'll help them set up, you know, the trip of their dreams or their vacation. They don't have time for it. So that's just a unique little way that he's found to give people the fish. And then third step, you know, ultimately what most of us want when it really comes down to it is we want to be happy, or we want to be happier. And most purchasing decisions of almost every kind, you know, relate to an emotional need or a desire to be happy or a desire to feel loved. I mean, that's why we buy luxury items, you know, for better or worse. You know, someone will buy a luxury purse or a briefcase because they think that it will help them feel better about themselves. And so the more you can relate your product or your service or your offer to this idea of making someone happy, the more successful it will be. And so as I traveled the world, you know, I did these 1,500 case studies, talked with lots of people. I often asked them the question, how does your business help people? And it was really fascinating to get the different information because some people would give very descriptive answers and other people were more astute. And so when I met Barbara in California, Barbara owns a ranch where people can come and stay for a week and they can ride horses and sit around the campfire. And I asked her, how does your business help people? She didn't tell me anything about, you know, what they actually did. What she said is, you know, the purpose of our ranch, we help someone, we help people be someone different for a day. We help people, you know, feel differently, be differently. Our message is, come stay with us and you'll be a cowboy. Come stay with us and you'll be a cowgirl. And I thought that was, you know, such a much more powerful message than saying, come and stay with us and, you know, ride a horse around or sit at the campfire or whatever. So that's Barbara's message. The message of the book overall is, you know, look at what all these people did in different ways. It's very specific. But they're different ways, but they all followed a similar pattern. And here's how you can do it, too. It doesn't take a lot of money. When people talk about starting a business, often the first question they have is, how can I get the money to start up? You know, what are my startup costs and how can I get that? I think that's the wrong question most of the time. I think the right question is, how will this business make money? And what can I do for this business to make more money? And how can I get this going to where I make money in 30 days? You know, and what other ways can I make money? How can I create sustainability? That's the conversation I think is much more important, you know, as I learned from all of these individuals. And it also doesn't take a lot of special skills. It takes sometimes a repositioning of skills or a relearning or a transformation of skills, but not necessarily, you know, all new acquisition. So Sarah Young was a single mother who opened a yarn shop, also at the height of the recession. And I asked her, you know, why did you do that? And she said, well, I didn't really think about the recession. I thought about the opportunity that I saw around me. And other stores were closing, and rents were low, and there was an abundance of good employees. You know, that's what I thought about. And I said, well, how did you know to do that? You know, you weren't an entrepreneur. And she said, I wasn't an entrepreneur, but I was a shopper. And I knew what I wanted, and it didn't exist, you know, so I found a way to create that. And Sarah knew what other people wanted as well, and that's what she did in creating Happiness, the retail shop, which is doing very well. So as I said, I believe in defining your own success, and when I think about, you know, what I hope to be the success of the book, I think of three things. The first thing I think of is that I hope that it inspires readers. And I would encourage everyone to think about two questions. First of all, you know, the book is all about freedom and value. So I would encourage you to answer for yourself, do you have enough freedom in your life? Are you able to do the things that you love to do, you know, most of the time? Are you spending most of your time on the things that you love? And then secondly, because freedom and responsibility are directly related, are you creating enough freedom for someone else? You know, are you making the world a better place? Do you feel like you're doing that? And so the first thing is to inspire, and the second thing is to educate for all those people out there who want to do this, who want to achieve that freedom, but they don't know what the next step is. You know, the book is 300 pages of next steps and data and, you know, charts and graphs and all kinds of information about how to price your business and how to do a product launch and how to get the word out, how to franchise yourself to be in more than one place, you know, and all kinds of things like that. But the third and final thing is, you know, I hope that for those who read it, the book will create a sense of urgency and a sense of urgency to take action because we live in this beautiful age, this remarkable age where we can come to Austin and hang out with lots of great people. And even after we leave, we can be connected online and we can go online and, you know, communicate with tens of thousands of like-minded people or people who have the same goals or similar ideas or values or are pursuing something of their own. And I think it's I think it's great, but I also think with so many opportunities, you know, we should not squander them. So I like what Steve Jobs said. He said, your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. And in different ways, that's what, you know, everyone in the $100 startup is a living testament to, as well as many people, you know, in the community that I'm fortunate to write for. I feel like there's so many people that are providing, you know, a good model of that quote of living their own lives and defining their own future. And I hope that you'll do that in your own way as well. Thanks for having me. We'll do a couple questions. That's great. We'll do a couple questions, and then when we run out, I'll be down at the bookstore, and I'll give away books for whoever's there. Questions? Everybody's good to go? All right. Yes. What am I doing next? Well, I'm really looking forward to the launch of the book, and I'll be doing a tour. So I'm doing 25 cities in North America, and then we're going to do the world's first 7-continent book tour. So going out around the world, eventually to Antarctica. So I hope you'll come. Yes? So the question, what was your name?
Charlotte.
Charlotte's asking me, some of you may know I'm on this personal quest to visit every country in the world, and I'm coming to the end of it, and so she's asking me if I'm scared, you know, of what happens at the end, because I only have 10 countries left. And that's a very good question, and the funny thing is I actually do feel a little bit scared, because this has, like, been a big part of what I do and my identity for a long time, and I'm not sure what's coming next, but it's also an exciting thing, because hopefully it will, you know, allow me to do some different things, too. Maybe one more question?
Chris.
Yeah, what's up? What's my favorite country? Well, Australia, of course. But secondly, no, I don't have a single favorite country. Maybe I have like a number of places I like for different reasons. And I also think that a lot of travel is contextual. Like some people can go to one place and have a totally different experience than someone else. So it often depends on what your own personal experience is there. But a few places that I would really look forward to spending more time after next year would include Australia and also Macedonia. I spent a lot of time in Ghana. I would love to go back there. Hong Kong, Lithuania. I don't know if I'd consider going back to Nauru. I just visited the world's smallest island republic called Nauru. There's 11,000 people on the island, and I was there 4 days, and he was asking me how was that, and I said it was maybe 3 days too long. Are we good? Okay, one more. Or not. That's okay. Guys, thank you so much.